Thieves of State, Why Corruption Threatens Global Security, by Sarah Chase. Afghanistan, 2009. One day, an elder named Nurallah from Hijran Karez, a village over the rocky ridge of the East Town, came and knelt on our floor to tell us his story. His brother Najib had gone to Chaman, just across the border in Pakistan. He paid at every checkpoint, on the way back. When he reached the entrance of the town, the police there wanted 500 Afghanis, but he refused. They broke the window and smacked him. He paid the money, but then he pulled over to the side of the road and called Nurallah, who told him to stay right there, then called police chief to report the officer who was taking the bribes. Nurallah was once a police officer himself, but the police buzzers had seen Najib make the call. They had descended on him, snatched the phone out of his hand, and smashed it. "My sacred oath," he vowed, concluding, "if I see someone planting an IED on a road, and then I see a police truck coming, I will turn away. I will not warn them." If a former police officer like him was even mouthing such thoughts, then others were acting on them. Afghan government corruption was manufacturing Taliban. Acute government corruption may in fact lie at the root of some of the world's most dangerous and disruptive security challenges, among them the spread of violent extremism. Revolt against kleptocracy. The Arab Spring, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, 2011. There was evidence that several of governments of Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia had deliberately targeted their oppression against the most thoughtful, reasoned, and moderate leadership over the years, while covertly facilitating militant groups to serve as ogres to scare people. Populations across the Arab world rebuffed religious extremism and ignited a popular uprising, focusing on dignity, social justice, and sustenance, not just the empty form of democracy. What was pushing people over the edge in Morocco was not just poverty or misfortune in general, it was poverty in combination with acute injustice, the visible, daily contrast between ordinary people's privations and the ostentation display of lavish wealth corruptly siphoned off by ruling cliques from what was broadly understood to be public resources. In Algeria, overwhelmingly, even a decade or more after the last of the violence that had traumatized the nation in the 1990s, the sentiment people expressed was relief. One woman said, when asked whether she wished for a revolution like Tunisia's, "We're happy just to be at peace." In Tunisia in March 2011, it was still high on euphoria over what it had wrought. "It isn't about unemployment. It's about a mafia running this country. It's about bullying, extortion, and public sector bribery." Beneath these, Tunisians' urgency floated a growing fear, whose contours were already visible. If the revolution against kleptocracy did not deliver some measure of improved social justice, the people, in their frustration, might radicalize after all. The Overlooked Military Kleptocracy Complex. Egypt, 2010. Central to the demands of the Egyptian revolutionaries was a halt to the rampant corruption that disfigured the government of Hosni Mubarak. Protesters were demanding the return of stolen or squandered funds and the reinvestment to benefit the general interest. The Egyptian military is hardly innocent of just the type of arrogation of public resources these protesters were denouncing. The military, however, remains connected in people's minds to the Free Officers Movement, the birth of the Egyptian Republic in the early 1950s, and nationalist hero Gamal Abdel Nasser, with his emphasis on social welfare. The army assiduously maintained that myth. By means of a barrage of media propaganda, the Egyptian military remains a powerful symbol and is seen as adding some measure of value to the community. In January 2011, the resolved Egyptian population pushed beyond the breaking point of the kleptocratic transformation, erupted in a nonviolent, non-sectarian revolt. It was not just a religiously inspired uprising. In fact, a majority of engaged Egyptians later recoiled at the Muslim Brotherhood's ability to use the entrenched local networks to capture the fruits of a revolt it had been slow to join. Still, many, at least initially, saw the Brotherhood as the only clean alternative to the old regime. The Islamist Movement political party ran in national elections and squeaked out a victory. Hardly a year later, the old security services moved and toppled the Muslim Brotherhood-linked administration. The Egyptian military erased any remaining indistinction between nonviolent political Islam and radical extremists by branding the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization. The Post-Soviet Kleptocratic Autocracy. Uzbekistan, 2013. In Uzbekistan, the flashy money grubbers who had suddenly appeared at the top of the pyramid were symbolized by the aging dictator's oldest daughter, Gulnora Karimova. She established herself as an unavoidable intermediary for major private investment in Uzbekistan, with an emphasis on the telecommunications sector. She mastered the art of circumventing law by law. People there are looking for social justice, not abstract concepts of democracy or human rights. The only people who talk politics and social justice these days are the Islamists. They have legitimacy because of their works for charity. The argument they are making is that the regime is corrupt and unjust because it's secular. Such reasoning did not have much resonance in the past. Now it does. But the Karamov regime is quick to label devout Muslims, or people who refer to religious principles to guide their conduct, as radicals. As for frustrated Uzbeks, a virulent, exiled jihadi group does exist. It is called the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, or the IMU, and is active in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and other parts of the region. U.S. intelligence sources say that evidence recovered from Osama bin Laden's compound in Pakistan records a spate of Uzbek recruits and contributions to the IMU and Hizbu Tahrir in the wake of the Andijan massacre. The Resource Kleptocracy. Nigeria, 2014. Boko Haram, roughly translated as Western education is forbidden, ritually forbidden, that is, unclean, is a group of violent Islamic extremists which burst onto the international stage in the summer of 2009. It initially had the principle of kicking back against the corruption in the state. It wasn't against Western education per se. Western education was seen as a tool for corruption, for oppression. According to residents of Kano, one of the oldest cities in West Africa, the police preside over the illicit trade in the town's bustling main market, extracting their cut from the sale of counterfeit medicine and other dangerous goods. They frequently impound cars and motorcycles. They arrest people and don't take them to court. And they begin negotiating their release. They routinely board vehicles at improvised checkpoints on highways and city streets to shake passengers down. This is the environment in which Boko Haram launched its campaign of attacks on the police. Even among Nigerians who disapprove of the group's aims, the violence was initially acclaimed. According to the Nigerian government's own figures, public investment has been exceptionally low, even by African standards. Underinvestment in transportation infrastructure and power generation has also damaged the food industry. Nigeria's manufacturing has also largely died out, victim of privatization to cronies under pressure from the IMF, and customs and tariff regimes designed for members of the kleptocratic networks to work around. The second tipping point on Nigeria's path to kleptocracy was, ironically, its conversion to civilian rule in 1999. Still, while disgust was widespread, and the dramatic political violence often laced with sectarianism grabs international headlines, Nigerians direct much of their ire not at elected official, but at the civil service. Many Nigerian Pentecostal churches emphasized the puritanical lifestyle required of members. Such puritanical focus on personal behavior has increased in recent decades as corruption metastasized beyond the confines of officialdom to infect nearly all Nigerians' behavior. Such generalized ethical collapse encourages militant groups on both sides of the religious divide to preach personal morality as a cure for society's ills. Many Nigerians believe the political elites are deliberately trying to give that violence a sectarian cast, as the country is increasingly described in North versus South, Muslims versus Christian terms. The elites say ordinary Nigerians are the only ones with anything to gain in such a contest. The poor suffer equally, no matter who is in power. Violent extremists. Rome, wrote the Father Martin Luther, master of arts and sacred theology, is full of buying, selling, bartering, changing, trading, drunkenness, lying, deceiving, robbing, stealing, luxury, knavery, and so on. And out of this sea, the same kind of morality flows into the entire world. He criticized the widespread purchase of office. No bishop can be conformed unless he pays a huge sum for his pallium. Legal cases over purely temporal matters are called to Rome, he complained, where judges are ignorant of local laws, justice or injustice is sold, and excommunication is used as a threat to blackmail people. Monasteries are given over to caretakers who appoint some apostate, renegade monk, who sits all day long in the church selling pictures and images to the pilgrims. They have bound us to their canon law and robbed us of our rights, so that we have to buy them back again with money. Luther was hardly the first to lash out at the corruption of the Catholic Church. Without a doubt, the Reformation, which ignited wars and toppled kingdom, and one of the most sweeping upheavals in Western history, was a revolution against kleptocracy. Riots leaped from the towns of the southern Netherlands to the north, leaving behind the smoking and amputated ruins of thousands of buildings, and the torn and twisted remains of vestments, chalices, altars, statues, paintings, plate, books, and even kegs of wine and costly butter. It has been called iconoclasm. And indeed the rioters were after icons. or religious images whose presence in a place of worship they considered idolatrous. But they did not attack just images. They fell upon all the manifestations of the wealth and riches that the church had been extorting for so long and parading before their eyes. The ferocity of the destruction speaks to the depths of the people's rage. In periods of acute, self-serving behavior on the part of the public leaders, Christians and Muslims alike have often sought a corrective in strict codes of personal behavior derived from the precepts of puritanical religion, and they have imposed it, if necessary, by force. Remedies. Violent religious extremism is not the only menace to international security that systemic corruption can fuel. Other threats to world stability are also generated by intense systemic government corruption. Acutely corrupt governance doesn't just aid terrorist organizations by driving indigent citizens into their arms. It provides a haven and logistical support for those very same groups as officials avert their eyes in exchange for a bribe. Some corrupt governments, like Algeria's or Pakistan's or Yemen's, may deliberately cultivate terrorist groups, even while simultaneously projecting themselves as counter-terrorism allies, to tap into a continuing flow of military assistance dollars. Incentives. A strategic and synchronized campaign to reduce acute corruption must also include rewards and incentives for reforms, loans and grants, development assistance, provision of equipment, and valuable contracts are all potential incentives. Trade-off. Policy decisions are always the product of trade-offs between competing or even conflicting priorities or options, or policy preferences promoted by different government agencies. Some of the considerations weighing on policymakers that may conflict with an anti-corruption agenda include the value of maintaining a given relationship, especially when it is seen as the least bad, in a tough neighborhood, or when the country in question has become a sole source of needed goods, facilities, or services. Other trade-offs include the demand for natural resources a country might possess, its pivotal geopolitical position and relationship, or its presumed ability to do harm. Pressure on such governments may precipitate instability in their countries, or their leaders may suggest that it will, presenting short-term kleptocratic stability as the only alternative to chaos, without an accurate measure of those risks, however, or the true likely costs and benefits of all courses of action, policy trade-off will be based on false premises, a skewed calculus.